breaking news to report. You're looking at a live picture of the World Trade Center, where we have just received word that a plane apparently has crashed into the tower.
Roaring engines coming. We looked up and there was a plane. Next thing you know, we heard boom. We ran up to the corner and hit right into the World Trade Center.
10 years ago, the world was stunned by the September the 11th terror attacks.
There is smoke now billowing out of the top of the World Trade Center.
Oh my God almighty, the black smoke all over the place. There's got to be somebody killed in it.
19 terrorists hijacked 4 passenger planes to carry out a synchronized suicide mission.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center.
A second plane crashed into the building at the opposite end.
That's not an accident, that's on purpose.
Second airplane went in on the other side of the World Trade Center, plane number two.
Two planes were flown into the World Trade Center in New York, exploding into giant balls of flame and causing the Twin Towers to buckle and collapse like a deck of cards.
It was surreal. As we looked at it, we thought it was something out of a movie. It just didn't seem real. The airplane just came in at a tilt. We heard the scream of the plane, then a crack, 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 boom, 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 and the plane just disappeared. You didn't see the plane anymore, and then you saw the blowout from the other side.
A third plane hit the Pentagon, striking close to the heart of the American government, while another crashed down in a field in Pennsylvania.
Hold on 1 second, please.
I'm going to die, aren't I?
No. Say your...
I'm going to die.
Ma'am, say your prayers.
I love you. I'm in the World Trade Center. The building was hit by something. I don't know if I'm going to get out, but I love you very much.
Ma'am? Stay calm.
We tried to do a floor-by-floor search, New York City Police, the Fire Department, Port Authority Police, best they could, tried to get everybody out.
People just kept jumping, and you could still see they were alive because they were flailing around.
I must have saw about 7 or 8 bodies flying through the air, coming from 80 floors up, and you just saw them cartwheeling down, bouncing off the building. It was devastating.
Move it! Come on!
Almost 3,000 people from more than 90 countries were killed on September the 11th.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us.
And there, as you can see, perhaps the second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing.
67 of those victims were British.
Good Lord, there are no words.
This is the story of 9/11 through the eyes of Britons who experienced it.
Planes were hitting, buildings were falling, people were on the streets screaming and crying.
And Britons whose lives were changed forever by it.
All the securities throughout your entire life are quite literally blown away.
This is 9/11, the British story. For thousands of New Yorkers, September the 11th, 2001 began as a beautiful, clear day in early autumn. As British expats mingled with Americans heading off to work, no one could have predicted what was about to happen.
My name is Stephen Eustace. I've been in New York for approximately 20 years now. Originally from Reading, I moved out here in 92 and never wanted to go back. I remember the day quite vividly. I stepped outside of my apartment on West 10th Street in Greenwich Village, and it was a beautiful crimson blue sky, one of those stunning days, breezy, everything felt good. And as I stepped onto 6th Avenue, I saw some people looking up, and as you do, you turn around, looked up, and there was this huge gaping hole in one of the towers. Obviously a plane had hit it, but from where I stood, I couldn't really tell what kind of plane. So I looked at it for a few minutes, then I ran back to grab my video camera to see what was going on a bit clearer, and also to grab my fiancé at the time and tell her something had happened to the World Trade Center.
My name's Tara Montgomery. I'm from Beaconsfield in England and spent 13 years here already. My September 11th started not an entirely normal day. It was an election day, actually. So I got up a little early, went down to the polling station to cast my vote. I had a strange sort of feeling that day, and I had been wearing a certain pair of shoes when I walked down to vote and decided they were uncomfortable and that if I ever needed to run anywhere, I needed to go home and change my shoes. So I went back to my apartment and put on some comfortable shoes and took the subway into work, got off the subway around 9 and went to get coffee as usual at the Empire State Building. And the sirens went off inside the Empire State Building. And there was a call to evacuate. And nobody moved. And people said, why would we evacuate? And somebody said, there's been a fire at the World Trade Center. And people started to say, well, that's really far from here. That's probably a couple of miles. Why would we need to move? So I shouted out in the coffee shop, it must be a terrorist attack. Otherwise, they wouldn't be telling us to get out of another landmark.
The World Trade said that Tower number 1 is on fire.
We just had a plane crash into level 4 of the World Trade Center.
The whole outside of the building was just a huge explosion.
We have a number of floors on fire. It looked like the plane was aiming towards the building.
On WCBS 880.
We are just currently getting a look at the World Trade Center. We have something that has happened here at the World Trade Center.
Just a few moments ago, something believed to be a plane crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center.
We both hit the streets. I zoomed in, and my wife actually was the one who approximated that it was probably a very large plane that had hit the World Trade Center. And just the crowd started growing and growing on the street as we all looked up, trying to establish what had happened. So we're all staring, we're all looking up, we're all guessing. I'm staring through my camera. I think it was a reporter or someone behind me, someone who was on a telephone. And I sort of looked down for a second, and then there was some shouts, and as another plane approached, and we looked out and we saw the other plane hit the second tower.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center.
We're being told a second plane crashed into the building on the opposite end.
That's not an accident, that's on purpose.
Second airplane went in on the other side of the World Trade Center, plane number 2.
Apparently that was another plane. We have a witness who we just spoke to a moment ago.
It's been another one, Carl.
Yes, he hit in building number 1.
The other building.
Yes, he flew right into it.
That's when the mood completely changed. Everyone went from a sense of questioning and awe of what might have happened to knowing exactly what happened. I naively thought that surely two planes couldn't misjudge and hit the World Trade Center. And my wife was like, oh my God, we're under attack.
There's debris flying out of that South Tower.
We saw a burst of flames a moment ago just before
that
we talked with
you. That was the aircraft that just hit building number 1.
At that stage, and I think on the video it captures, there's a little bit of sort of screaming as people cry out, can't quite understand what's going on. I sort of zoom in, catch some of the flames and stuff that are going on at the time to try and find out what's going on. I didn't really know what to do except look through the camera. So we're all watching this as it's going on, then sort of ambulances and fire engines and all kinds of stuff are heading down there. There's lots of sirens going off.
I went to my office across the street and went upstairs to try and find out what was going on. I turned on my computer and there was an email there, and I actually brought it. It's from my father at 9:32 that morning saying, we've been watching the World Trade Center fire live since just a few minutes ago, since the first plane hit. We're watching the first fire. We saw the second plane clearly hit just before. It was a huge ball of fire. It's 9:30 your time. Bush is on the TV. Mother is desperate for me to call you. None of your numbers are working. We're trying to find a number. Call or email when you can. We'll continue to try and call. We assume you're okay. You're quite a distance away. That was the first information any of us in our building got, and it was from my family in England emailing me. And for me as a British person, it was bizarre really that a bunch of New Yorkers that were feeling in danger got their news from an email from London. So I said to my colleagues, we need to get out of here. Something big is happening. This email was the first time we knew a second plane had hit. Because already communications were coming down because the receivers for radio and telephones and so on were on the World Trade Center buildings. So I left the building with a colleague of mine and we began to walk downtown. We actually walked right past where we're sitting now at 23rd Street, Madison Square Park. It must have been 10 something by then. and all the cars had stopped, all the taxis had stopped. Everybody rolled down their windows and their radios were blaring the news from the local radio station. And we were trying to get information about what was going on.
And then, of course, one of the towers came down.
Oh my God!
And what appears to be a complete collapse surrounding the entire area. Tower 2.
The South Tower, major collapse. T3, a major collapse in one of the towers.
The North Tower of the World Trade Center simply collapsed, like something you would see in a video.
I cannot see the South Building right now.
The building once stood, there is nothing but smoke. There is
smoke. Side of it crumbled with smoke and a lot of sparks coming out.
It's a tremendous building, one of the largest in the world.
The entire side just crumbled to the ground. It almost.
We looked straight down the road just over there and saw a huge cloud of smoke, and everyone in the park right here just screamed, the towers must be falling.
That's when people really started screaming and crying on the streets. It was truly disturbing at that point, because the death toll, you just didn't know how to gauge it. No one knew how many people were there, so people on the streets just knew that it was going to involve rescue teams, people in the buildings, people trying to escape.
We are running north on Broadway. We are escaping an enormous cloud of dust and debris that is racing up Broadway behind us.
And then the radio came on, and there was screaming through the radio and panic around here, because nobody knew if there were more incidents going to happen, and we thought we're still near tall landmark buildings, will there be more planes? That was the main thing at the time, was the fear of what was next, rather than being scared of what had just happened, which is obviously a sort of self-preservation thing. And it's funny to look back and think that our primary reaction was fear of the unknown rather than shock at what had just happened. I did know that nobody close to me worked or lived near the World Trade Center. A couple of people worked reasonably close, so I was worried about them. I had no way of contacting them. Nobody could use their cell phones, all the circuits were busy. And another strange thing for me was that I could call England from my cell phone, because I guess the international circuits were freer. So I was still on the phone walking downtown on my cell phone to England, hearing a live commentary from what they could see happening a mile from here.
From the moment the first plane struck the Twin Towers, firefighters raced to the scene.
Brooklyn Dispatch, urgent. People trapped, 5 World Trade on the 80th floor. 3 World Trade, that's the 101 floor and the 102 floor. Manhattan received.
Without a thought for their lives, many entered the burning towers.
My name's John Williamson. At the time of 911, I was an assistant chief fire officer, and I was a close friend of Peter Gansey, who was the chief of department of FDNY.
Engine 1 out of Manhattan.
Engine 1 out.
Roll every available ambulance you got to this position.
I can remember where I was when the Twin Towers were hit very clearly. I'd gone over to see an old school friend of mine who was having a few problems. And we were going to go out to lunch. And it was during that period, and we'd called in a shop. And somebody told us about it in the shop and said, come and have a look at it on the TV. And that's how I heard about it. Never ever forget it like everybody else. I don't think any of us will ever forget what we saw.
The World Trade said that tower number one is on fire. The whole outside of the building was just a huge explosion.
My first thoughts were of Pete. Obviously, an incident of that magnitude, I knew would the chief would be there. And knowing Pete, he would be leading from the front, as he always did. And that was worrying, because I think every firefighter in the UK that saw that, in fact the world over, would know that that was only going to end in tears, and it was that a lot of firefighters and other people's lives were in absolute peril.
Wherever it was, at the north side of the building, fire vented from at least one floor, heavy smoke all over the front and on the top of the building, approximately 90-something floor, okay?
I repeatedly tried phoning New York to their house, the private house on Long Island, but without success. It was engaged all the time, and I later found out it wasn't just the lines to their house, it was routing through New York, because most of the telecommunications, I believe, routed through the masts on the top of the Twin Towers, ironically. My wife and I, at the time, talked it through and through. Other people had phoned me that knew that Pete was my close friend, and indeed a lot of people here felt the same way. I mean, bear in mind that when I brought Pete over, I took him round the fire stations, and he sat down in front of all our people and just spoke and just said, he never called himself the chief. He just said he was a firefighter from New York. So loads of people knew it.
10-4, we have units on the way up now. We report a fire on the 78th floor.
Inside the burning towers, firefighters had climbed the stairs, story after story, to reach people who were trapped.
What floor are you on, Scotty? 54. All right, keep making your way up. We're behind you.
What was going through my head when I saw the buildings come down is clearly that a lot of firefighters would have been in or around the bottom of the building. And that would, of course, have included Pete. If you'd never seen how vast they were, even the city area below it, there was a train station, an underground station underneath it. There were shops and shopping malls, and it was almost like a mini city underneath it. It was ginormous. And if you envisage that those two buildings are going to come down on top of all that, then clearly that's not going to happen without tremendous loss of life. So yeah, I knew. And I think every one of us in the fire department would have also known, and in the fire service throughout the world would have known, that firefighters would have died there.
We got injured people up here on 70. See if they can somehow get elevated past the 40th floor. We got people injured all the way up here.
Didn't think that Pete would have been inside the building as chief, because he would have been directing the operations, which in fact he was. But to be close to a building of that size and see two of them come down and escape from it, I mean, we all saw the footage, remarkable footage, of people literally running for their lives when the buildings came down and the great big dust cloud. We all saw that, and I think that's something that will live with, certainly live with me forever.
Major collapse. Urgent, urgent. Somebody get out. We had a collapse
in the second tower. Second tower of the World Trade Center has just completely collapsed.
Can anybody hear me? I'm a civilian. I'm trapped inside of one of the fire trucks. I can't breathe much longer.
It's just astonishing. People in the newsroom crying, hugging each other. What a scene today. I'm shaking. I mean, it's just horrifying.
It was just incredible. It was this massive nuclear-like smokestack that came out of, you know, the bottom of Manhattan. It looked like the whole of Lower Manhattan had been absorbed by this smoke, like disappeared. Like the whole thing had been blown up. They just couldn't believe this was happening and that all those people were going to be killed. I suppose it's hard to express. I don't think I have the ability to express what that feeling was. It just happened, and then you reacted, and then you watched to see what was going to happen next. It was just a series of events that you were participating in. It was a kind of like a blockbuster movie. Strangely, you felt like you were in the middle of some kind of summer movie blockbuster. Things were just happening. Planes were hitting, buildings were falling, people were on the streets screaming and crying, planes were going overhead, news was coming out fast.
There were thousands of people in the streets and everybody was purposefully walking somewhere, but really nobody knew where they were going. They were just trying to find somewhere safe. There was a lot of noise from car radios, cars parked on the side of the curb. Especially taxis had their windows wound down and put the radios on really loud, and there were circles of people around the taxis listening to the local news through the taxi and trying to figure out what to do and what information there was. We were told that the bridges and tunnels were closed. And so as somebody that lived in Brooklyn, which is across the river, I couldn't go home. My friend and I started to go towards the East Village, which is a residential neighborhood with low buildings. And we had this conversation about where would be a safest part of Manhattan to go that is less likely to be attacked. And we thought, you know, maybe a residential neighborhood with low buildings might be less vulnerable. So we were walking there and ran into an English friend who was out looking for water or something. His wife was pregnant at home, and he invited us into his house, and we waited there for a few hours, still trying to use the phone, still not able to make local calls, and still relying on my phone to call England for more news. And later in the day, when the bridges reopened, we chose to walk across the Williamsburg Bridge, which is sort of the least architecturally important bridge probably. And we thought, well, this is probably the least likely to be a target. So we walked across that bridge, and the smoke at that point and the ash were everywhere. And walking across the bridge, there were little pieces of paper and flying around, and it smelt horrible, and there was smoke in the air. And we actually stopped at a hardware store that was open and bought little masks to wear. A lot of people were wearing masks already. And there's a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood on the other side, and one that's traditionally very insular, but all the residents had come out to the end of the bridge with little cups of water, and there were hundreds of us walking across the bridge, just all these pedestrians, really, really hot. I was thankfully wearing my comfortable shoes because of what I had done that morning. And we were greeted with water and made our way home. And it was so touching that this community had come out to, you know, welcome us home.
At this stage, people were trying to understand what to do with themselves. Me and my wife were sort of looking at each other, and I think we came to the same conclusion as everyone else, that we should go to the nearby hospital and get blood if we can. And so we lined up in this very large line. I mean, it must have been about a block and a half long, expecting there to be a great deal of injuries and ambulances arriving with people with injuries. And it was quite a sobering view of the outside of the hospital, where you saw just chairs wrapped in white sheets and tables ready, just things ready to wheel all these victims. And as we queued up, nobody arrived. Nothing arrived. They just stayed there. It was white sheets the whole time. Nobody came, no ambulances, nothing.
We thought there would be a lot of injuries and that our blood would be needed. As someone who grew up in Britain, I was turned away. And it was at that time that I learned that even now, if you lived in Britain in the 80s, you were at risk of mad cow disease and are not allowed to donate blood. So there I was, feeling so helpless at the hospital, being turned away when we thought there was such a need for blood. And I wanted to go to another hospital and lie and not and tell them I wasn't in England. So that was bizarre that we found that out, and that you couldn't do something to help because you were British. When I got home, the first thing I did was check my email, and saw the hundreds of emails coming in from friends and family in Britain and elsewhere, and contacting them all to say I was okay. And that was one thing. We were also just exhausted. I didn't go to sleep that night. I lay awake because of the smell, of the horrible smell of the burning, which had drifted all the way to Brooklyn. The next day, I went with my flatmate to the firehouse, which was a couple of buildings away from where I lived. And we went to pay our respects because we understood that men had been lost fighting the fire at the World Trade Center, like many firehouses in New York. So that night of 12th of September, we shyly knocked on the front door of the firehouse, and someone let us in, and we just said we wanted to say sorry that this had happened to their people. they invited us in and cooked us dinner. And they said, sit down, we all need each other now. And it became a friendship between my flatmate Debbie and I and the members of the Dean Street Firehouse. The rest of that week, we were all told by Giuliani, and in fact by my boss, to act normal and defy what had happened by living a normal life to the extent we could. So everybody pushed through and, you know, got on the subway, went to work, went about our business. And in a way, as somebody that was in England in the 70s and during the time of the IRA, I was familiar with that way of life, that we faced that. There was fear, there was the threat of bombings and so on, but you didn't let that stop your life. You still got on the tube, you still went to Harrods at Christmas. The back of your mind, you thought, I'm taking a risk, but you knew you couldn't let that control you. So when Americans were experiencing this kind of violence on their mainland for the first time, I remember talking to them about what it was like to grow up during the time of the IRA's activism in mainland Britain, and saying, this is how we coped. And they were interested in that.
In Britain itself, millions of people saw the horror unfold on television. 9/11 would claim 67 British victims, tearing apart once happy families. Elizabeth Turner was 7 months pregnant with her first child. As she watched the Twin Towers burning on television, her husband was trapped inside the 106th floor of the North Tower.
Simon and I were just really normal people. I'd grown up in Yorkshire and Simon had grown up in Stockport near Manchester. And we'd both come down to London at different stages. But we had worked really hard. We both loved our jobs. We were both very career orientated. And we were reaping the benefits in that respect. We'd just bought a new house. And it was a really, really normal life. And we were really happy. And I think the thing was that we'd built everything together and we had worked hard to get to where we were. We both had a deep appreciation of what we'd found in each other and were really working hard together to build our future life. So when I fell pregnant, it was all wonderful because it was us creating our new home together for our, not just us, but for the family. Simon was the publishing director for a company called Risk Waters, and the Waters part of the magazine was based in New York. The Monday evening, so the 10th of September, he flew over. And he always knew that I was always very apprehensive when he flew. Being 7 months pregnant and extremely hormonal, I was a lot more apprehensive. So while I was asleep, Simon would always leave me a message on my mobile phone to say, I've arrived, I'm safe, I'll speak to you in the morning. So when I woke up on the Tuesday morning, which was the 11th, the message was there on my mobile saying, I've arrived, I've gone to the hotel, and I'll speak to you later. I went off to work at Channel 4, and about 12 o'clock my phone rang and it was Simon, and we talked about this buggy that I really needed to get for the baby and couldn't get it ordered anywhere, and Simon spent most of the conversation reassuring me that when he came home we would get everything sorted and we would sort out the buggy and we were making plans for the weekend. And that was it. And we said goodbye and I went off for lunch at Channel 4. And Simon set up the conference. So him and his colleagues would have easily have been there from 7:30 in the morning setting up the conference. And I think none of them would have had any idea what was about to happen.
Now, some very, very sketchy details reaching us here at Sky Centre. Important enough to bring to you, though, at this early stage. We believe that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Centre in New York.
So we'd finished lunch and come back upstairs, and it was about 2:45. So in Channel 4, as you can imagine, we had televisions hanging from the ceiling. So we came back from lunch, I walked into my office and Sky News was on, with the breaking news tagline going across the bottom of the screen saying that something had hit the World Trade Center.
That happened within the last few moments. No details at this stage as to what sort of plane it is.
I think at that point, I and everybody else thought there had been like a small biplane had gone into the World Trade Center, and it was an aviation mistake and nobody really knew what was going on. And at that point, you could only really see smoke coming out of the building. So my colleague then came in and said, have you seen what's going on the television? So I said, yes, I have. But as we were stood there, we literally saw the little black spot come onto the left-hand side of the screen, and as it flew into the second building.
As you can see, I don't know, you just saw the plane flying.
There's another explosion, another plane.
We just saw a plane flying by, waiting for it to come out of the other side of that building, and it didn't.
That then, as we all know, erupted into the huge fireball, and that's literally when I remember all the commentators started going berserk on the television.
Let's listen to our colleagues from New York.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center.
That was the point that I realized, but I think that was the point that the rest of the world realized, that it was a terrorist attack.
Some of the key suspects come to mind, Osama bin Laden, who knows what.
As I watched the second plane hit the second tower, I just remember a wave of cold fear rushing through my body. But as quickly as it rushed through, it's almost like the body locks down and says, we cannot take this information in, because if we take all of this information in immediately, she'll collapse. And so we're going to completely lock down, because actually there's something more important at play here, which is the baby. And I think that's really what I felt like. I felt like I had almost been taken out of my life and I was watching a film. And really that was where everything moved into slow motion. And I was very conscious of an enormous wave of panic went through me. But then at the same time, normal life, you kind of think, okay, well, this isn't going to happen. And I remember thinking, I don't know where he is. I know he's in the World Trade Center, but I don't know where he is. And then it's like you pull yourself together. And I thought, okay, well, I'm 7 months pregnant. He's my husband. Nothing awful is going to happen, because it just doesn't happen to people like that. But I don't really remember very much else about that afternoon. And from that day for about 6 months, all I have, it's like a photograph album. I have images of events that happened that are very clear in detail. But almost there's nothing in between. There's whole sections that I don't particularly remember in between. So that afternoon particularly, I remember thinking, we'll carry on with the HR meeting. So we transferred my phone to the HR director's secretary's phone. So if Simon called, I could talk to him. I remember desperately trying to get him on his mobile phone, but not getting an answer. My sister was also, she was 6 months pregnant. And she lived up in Northamptonshire. And I remember her phoning and saying, he's there, isn't he? And I said, yes, he is. And I remember feeling a sense of relief that somebody in my family was in contact with me. Whereas at work, I still felt like I was having to hold myself tight because I didn't quite know what was going on. So my sister and her husband jumped in the car in Northampton. They said, we're coming to get you. So I stayed at work until 6, and my sister and her husband picked me up. And I don't remember anything for the rest of that night. My brother-in-law later told me that he ordered pizza and fed 2 pregnant women. There was lots of phone calls and people contacting. And I don't think I had got any idea at that point of really what had happened. I think everybody else around me did. So everybody closed around me, looking after me, being pregnant. But I don't think I was very clear ultimately about what had really happened on that day.
That night, President Bush made a defiant speech on American television.
Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. Despicable acts of terror. The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger.
And John Williamson was finally receiving the news he'd feared since first seeing the Twin Towers collapse.
I remember going out for a walk in the early morning and got back, bearing in mind they're, 5 hours behind us. I phoned and I got through. I got through to the house and I spoke to Pete's daughter's boyfriend at the time. He knew who I was, obviously, and put me straight on to Pete's wife. And she just broke down and said, "I thought you would know John Pete was killed." And that's how I found out. She couldn't really tell me too much because it was between all the tears and the horrors. And she was angry. So I didn't know any of the details apart from what I read. But I did phone a mutual friend who was a very close friend of Pete's. In fact, it was his best friend who lived opposite. A chap called Steve Mosiello. And Steve and I had a long chat and he told me exactly what happened. And Pete managed, and Steve and others, including the mayor, had just escaped by the skin of their teeth. Of course, Pete went back to commanding the firefighting and had not long prior to that moved the command post. And it was at that command post in the street where Pete lost his life when the second tower came down.
In New York, a series of bomb scares and alerts followed. Katie Greenbank had just begun a one-year internship. She'd flown out of Britain just the day before 9/11.
I can't remember what was going through my head at the time. I think we were really in shock. And I was in my hotel room that I was sharing with one other girl, but she was out. And I remember just thinking, I need a shower and bed. I just need an early night. I'm too overwhelmed. So I had a shower, put my nightie on, had my hair wet, and then I heard a noise that sounded a bit like an old-fashioned politician's message when a car drives past and somebody with a megaphone is shouting, you know, "Vote for me, vote for me." And I listened, and it was actually coming from the corridor of the hotel. So I opened the door, and it was basically a tannoy alert from the hotel saying, "Security alert, evacuate." So I ran back into the room, didn't know what I was doing, just literally grabbed a coat, put on some trainers. So I had wet hair, trainers, a coat and my nightie. That's all I had on. Ran down the stairs. Obviously they said don't use the lift. So ran down the stairs, and as I was running, people were running in front of me, behind me. People were coming from all the stairwells. I remember nearly being whacked in the nose by a door that a woman opened in haste as we all tried to run down this block of stairs. And as we got to the foyer, there was two NYPD policemen, again looking like out of a film, just shouting at us to run for your life, run now. And somebody said that there was a bomb in the Empire State Building, and because we were just literally, it was directly above us, I just looked up, saw the Empire State Building looming, and just ran. And I ran and ran and ran, and people were running behind me, next to me, in front of me, from every side street. We were running. I could see hundreds of people running away from the Empire State Building, but I didn't know where I was running to because I didn't know where I was. And then I spotted one or two people who I'd met the day before. So we literally just all held hands and ran. We must have run for maybe 15, 20 blocks until I had an asthma attack. I couldn't run anymore. I just had to stop. And by then, we thought maybe we were further enough away. And then after a while, we started to walk back in the direction we'd come from. We could hear tannoys from NYPD cars saying, "Please, everybody return to their homes." And we just got back to the hotel and sat on the front step outside the hotel, just with our heads in our hands, just thinking, this is ridiculous. We want to go home. I remember thinking, I've got to go home. I can't cope with this. But all the airports we knew were shut at the time. And then an NYPD car pulled up outside, and the guy noticed that we were sat there and got out and said, "What's the matter?" So we said, "You know, we're new in New York. We're from Britain. We're scared to death. We've just been evacuated." And he said, "I've just lost many of my colleagues today. If I can carry on, so can you. Pull yourself together, get on with it." And that was it, and he drove away. But the following few days, we were evacuated so many times, and everywhere, even if we weren't evacuated, we were walking past people who were evacuating at the time. But all over New York, people were just constantly standing around on street corners.
The whole of Manhattan was standing on a street corner, it seemed.
In the days following 9/11, the rescue operation at Ground Zero turned into a recovery and cleanup mission. John Williamson and Katie Greenbank both visited the site.
When Steve took me to the site, it was almost like I can best describe it as a scene from a disaster film, really, to be honest. It just looked, everybody appeared stunned even then, and this was nearly a week afterwards, so everybody still appeared stunned. There were people working on the scene and literally working till they dropped. I mean, it really was a somber sight. It was something that was very odd. It was like from something else that I couldn't put my finger on what it was. What made me want to go over there was to just see if I could help, to see if I can lend support, to see if I could support the family and friends. The family were in pieces. Bearing in mind that Pete's eldest son, also called Pete, he'd just become a firefighter within a year of that incident. He was at the incident too.
The atmosphere was very strange. There was a lot of rubble and dust around. I remember looking into a jeweller's shop and it was still closed, and the sort of heads and shoulders that you place necklaces on were all on the floor, covered in dust, and it was very unnerving. And we just walked around it quietly, really. They had cordoned a lot of it off. You couldn't see the devastation. They had boarded it up. It looked like a big building site, but you could tell that it wasn't. And we actually went down a side street. I think we were a bit lost at the time. And we turned and we saw a massive pile of devastation, of rubble, really, that I think they should have probably cordoned off. But we saw that, and that was quite upsetting.
Back in the UK, Elizabeth Turner was slowly realising that her normal but very happy life was collapsing.
I kind of try to reiterate to people how normal Simon and my life was. You know, you were just going to work and you looked forward to weekends and you went out for dinner with friends and you went to the cinema and you trying to create a better life for yourselves. And then 11th of September comes along, and everything you have ever known, all the securities throughout your entire life, are quite literally blown away in that day. So you're completely disorientated. It's like there's nothing is the same anymore. With hindsight, I think the people who were immediately around me at that point already knew that Simon had died. But I was in no position to accept that. I was very conscious of not being the person who gave up on Simon. I was the person who is supposed to be the last person who gives up on Simon. And I kept thinking, what if he's in a hospital? What if he is trapped? What if? And I kept thinking all those things. And I thought, I'm the one that's supposed to be pushing. I'm the one who is supposed to be the last person standing, saying, have we looked at absolutely everything? The best man from Simon and my wedding, who was one of Simon's best friends, and then Simon's brother, Keith, they flew out to New York on my behalf. I needed to know that some people had gone over who knew him and would do as good a job at searching for him as I would. I didn't want him to be just a number or a name, or we've got to find this gentleman. I remember I used to phone his phone a lot just so I could hear the voicemail message, so I could keep hearing his voice. And I kept leaving messages for him. I think it must have been within the first week that I probably stopped using the mobile phone. I think a lot of that was, I think we did actually get a bill come through where we were able to see that all usage had stopped on the morning of September the 11th. You need to have confirmation. You have to have confirmation. If you don't have confirmation, it's an open-ended book. And without that confirmation, you're left in a limbo. I didn't get the police knocking on my door within 24 hours and saying, this is what's happened. It was completely open-ended. It was an unprecedented day. And what we became aware of was the fact that I was the only pregnant woman in the UK. There were lots of other pregnant women in the US, but I was the only one in the UK. And the press wanted to know. They wanted to know about me, they wanted to know about Simon. So the next morning, the 12th of September, I had friends who came round to see if they could do anything and wanted to know information. They're very good friends of mine, and one of them was leaving. So I went to the front door and gave a big hug and thank you for coming round and everything, we'll keep you in touch. We opened the door and there was definitely two, maybe three people stood on the front doorstep saying, please could we talk to Elizabeth Turner? So they basically asked whether I'd like to comment on the death of my husband in the World Trade Center. That was less than 24 hours from the first plane hitting. And we were inundated. We just had people knocking on the door all the time. The phone was ringing. They were knocking on the doors of my neighbours. It was relentless. But ultimately, you know, Simon was dead. And it was the 20th of September when Pete phoned through to the house and spoke to my elder sister, Deborah, and said, you know, we've done everything, but you know, we do know that he's dead. So that was the day that I was told, and that was the day, the 20th of September, that I accepted that that was what had happened, and that was the day that you then have to accept that your husband's dead, and you are on your own, and there's a baby on the way. I'd never in my entire life had any idea of how deep emotions could go to. And that was one of the most shocking things about Simon's death, was how incredibly intense your emotions can become, to the point you can't breathe. It's not like you've broken your leg. It's not like, you know, you're physically ill and people can see it. It's inside you. So actually, on the outside, you look okay. Inside, you are, it feels like quite literally you're being crushed to death. And to wake up every morning and feel that again was excruciating. That's the weird thing about being in that place. The intensity of the emotion is so painful that you just want it to stop. And the other part of it is that you can see how painful it is to other people to be watching you and they can do nothing. So you think, well, if I actually commit suicide, then I'm not going to have to deal with the pain. But at the same time, they're not going to have to deal with the pain. So surely that is a win-win situation for everybody. Of course it's not. And of course, anybody in a rational place would just think, oh, it's just ridiculous. But that is the reality of emotion and grief. And I've never been so deep in despair and sadness as I was at that period of time. But at the same time, I quite literally thought, if I do that, Simon would never forgive me. Even if there is one thing that holds you here, sometimes that can be enough. And for me, I think it was more around the fact that Simon would never forgive me if I killed myself, because that would have meant the baby too. So it just couldn't happen. So then you're faced with, so I have to live in this. How am I going to live in this? Because the reality is, there is a baby on the way. And that's not okay for a baby to be born with a mother who was in this space either. So that's kind of, they're the sort of, at that point, they were the other massive questions that I was having to face and deal with at the same time.
In November 2001, just over 2 months since losing her husband in the 9/11 terror attacks, Elizabeth gave birth to a baby boy.
I think the enormity of the responsibility was huge. But my immediate thought was when he was a boy was I was delighted because there was just that extra connection with Simon, with it being a boy. And the other thing that had been really special in all of it was that Simon and I had talked about names and we'd come up with the boy's name, William. But we hadn't come up with anything else. We hadn't come up with any girls' names and we hadn't even come up with a middle name. All we had was William. And it was lovely to have been able to say to William that I didn't choose his name. You know, his dad and I chose his name before he was born. And then, of course, his middle name just was perfect to give him his dad's name. So a number of people had said, would you call him Simon? But William needed to be himself. And there was the lovely connection to his dad, but he wasn't here to replace his dad. He was here to be himself with that connection to Simon.
William is now almost 10 and understands what happened to his father.
The thing that was helpful was because when William was born in the November, he didn't engage with his circumstances easily until he was 3. And so I had the luxury of being able to focus on my own grief and not having to focus on William's. I had to bring William up and I had to look after him as a baby and do all of those things. But it, for him, he needed just a warm, safe, loving home and have lots of people around him who loved him. So it wasn't really until he started nursery, I think, that he really got the fact that he didn't have a dad and other people do have dads. And I remember someone recently saying to me, you know, you've had the conversation with William. And it's not as simple as that. It's a conversation that you have, and I think I will always have with William. It's an ongoing conversation. It's going to be a lifetime conversation as he hits different stages in his understanding and his age and his development. And he starts seeing what goes on around the world. What I'd never wanted to do was put my experience onto William. So I could have sat down and just told him everything. But actually, William needed to understand what happened in his time, and I had to respect that. So he would ask me a question, and I would answer it, and then I would wait to see if he wanted anything else. And he would sometimes come back with another question. We'd exchange a few pieces of information. William would easily go away for a good 3 months and it was never talked about again. And then he would come back again. So it was respecting his need for information, but also respecting time for him to reflect on it and absorb it in the way a 4, 5, 6-year-old. And then when he went to school, it altered. And now he's nearly 10. You know, it's different. We can have conversations about it. But we don't have conversations about it all the time because it's a jigsaw puzzle and we keep filling up more and more pieces. And at some point, as William gets older, that jigsaw puzzle will become clearer to him and he will get to a point where he's got as much information as he needs. Or he can then start looking into information himself and not needing me to provide that for him.
Junior.
Edelmiro Abad.
Maria Rose Abad.
Andrew Anthony Abate.
Nearly 3,000 people died in the 9/11 terror attacks.
Lawrence Christopher Abel.
Millions of people around the world will never forget the moment they heard about 9/11.
And my husband, Sandy Ayala. We love you. We missed you.
Today offers a chance to reflect, a time to remember those who died, and an opportunity to look to the future.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky?